Hi, this is Jeffrey Lewis, and you're listening to CITR.
All right, I'm going to fade that out a bit. You are listening to CICR 101.9 FM, Dunkin' Donuts here. That was Megacolon, a song by Fisher Spooner. Don't know what's it about, really. Couldn't tell from the lyrics. But that goes out to my friend Sarah. Her birthday is tomorrow, and that's one of her favorite songs. So happy birthday, Sarah. I hope you have a great time. On today's show, we're going to hear a bunch of new stuff. Some new Final Fantasy, more new Final Fantasy, some new Deerhoof. And then on the second half of the show, we're going to hear a tribute to one of my favorite authors who passed away last Friday. So I'll talk more about that later. But let's get cracking with a song that I found recently online. I put a link to it on the blog, and it has been stuck in my head all week, and so I want to do the same thing to you guys. It's performed by the lead singer of the MC5, Rob Tyner, and it was from a TV performance he did in the 80s, and it's called Grandy Days. And I haven't been able to stop singing the song in my head. So I'm going to play that for you guys, and then I'm going to play some MC5 to give you a sense of contrast, a juxtaposition with the later song performed on autoharp solo, and the MC5, who burned down the place. They actually performed the song Kick at the Jams at the Grandy Ballroom. It was a live recording. So here is, without further ado, here's Robin Tyner with Grandy Days, and then we're going to hear some MC5 on CITR 101.9 FM.
I'd take you back with me to the heyday of the Grandy and all the wonders there to see. You see the walls ablaze with color, smell the incense in the air, hear the music sound and fury when the English bands were there. At the psychedelic ballroom, as the light show wheeled about, and all the people breaking freely while the towns were kicking out. Grandy days, Grandy days, I had some wild nights back in my Grandy days. Grandy days, Grandy days, I had some wild nights back in my Grandy days. You were there at the Grandy, I remember you. And wore rainbow-colored shoes. We were there with a chick in a miniskirt. They call her Sister Mystery. And one of us was blasted, and it wasn't her or me. Cause you spoke to me in dangle words, and you swore that it was true, that you could hear the colors, and you could see the music too. Some wild nights back in my Grandy days. Grandy days, Grandy days, I had some wild nights back in my Grandy days. Alone at night in the ballroom, I heard a mournful eerie call, as though a tortured soul was sobbing deep inside the wall. Of my memories of the Grandy, this one disturbs me most. I didn't believe the place was haunted till I heard the Grandy go. Grandy days, Grandy days, I had some wild nights back in my Grandy days. Wild nights back in my Grandy days. Now the ballroom stands empty. Nobody ever comes to play. They took out the PA system and put the light show away. If the Grandy could talk, what stories she would tell of when the music poured and thundered like fireworks from hell, of the violence out in the parking lot and the craziness backstage. When the teacup scene exploded and the Grandy was the latest rage. Grandy days, Grandy days, I had some wild nights back back in my granny day. Some wild nights back in my brandy day.
Right now it's time to take out the jams, motherfucker.
Thank you. outside till sun up on the doorstep. Your apartment could be very nice, oh, very nice. So kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. Kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. We are all custom made and like, oh, kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. Kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. We are all custom made. We're divorced. Except myself. All too much makeup and all too many makeups. All too much makeup and all too many makeups. 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 So kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. Kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. We are all custom made. Kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. Kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. We are all custom made and like. Kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. Kick out the chairs, motherfuckers. We are all custom made. We're divorced.
Sure what is going on there at the end of that song. That was James Murphy from LCD Sound System and someone called Monk on some album called Goma Gang 3. I don't really know the story behind that. It may be a remix of another song. I don't know. I love that song. It's very catchy. It's one of my dance floor favorites. If a party is sagging, you just drop that. And a little JT, and you know things are going to turn around real quick. Before that, we heard the MC5 with the title track from their famous, infamous 1968 album, Kick Out the Jams, recorded at the Grandy Ballroom, which was the subject of that song we heard before that, recorded by lead singer of MC5, Rob Tyner, and the song Grandy Days, all about the Grandy Ballroom. Oh, what such a bittersweet song. It kind of got me down for a little while, actually. I was very affected. If you Google WFMU and Rob Tyner, T-Y-N-E-R, you can watch the video for that song. And it's really, the video that they have for it is just, it's makes it so much better. It's him basically dressed as like a biker in the 80s with giant hair performing the song on an auto harp. It really, it's great. I'd like to remind you that Dunkin' Donuts is brought to you by the Biltmore Cabaret. Upcoming attractions include tonight, Corbin Murdoch and the Nautical Miles. Tomorrow night, Mohawk Lodge playing with Poor Folk, Japan Droids, and Lakefield. And word on the street is that Ryder, the lead singer of Mohawk Lodge, is moving to Toronto or something like that. So this might be your last chance for a while to see the rock that is Mohawk Lodge. Saturday night, Ndidi Anukjula, something like that, sorry to you, with Paul Piggott. And then Tuesday night, Brass Janot is having their EP release party with and Pop Montreal fundraiser. That's at the Biltmore Cabaret at 2755 Prince Edward, just off Kingsway and 12th. And check out biltmorecabaret.com for more information. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We've got a couple of new things coming up. Well, some new things. Let's see. Let me find the playlist here. We're going to hear Ultimatum. It's from the new Final Fantasy EP, Plays to Please. It's been put out by Blox, which is his Canadian... they're not really a label, but let's just call them a label. And in the U.S. on States Rights Records, which is a really cool record label. So good for Final Fantasy, keeping it real. And I haven't really heard too much about this. I've just heard the one song. There's six songs on this. It looks great. It's typical Final Fantasy. It should be amazing. You know what that means, typical. Amazing when it comes to Final Fantasy. After that, we're going to hear a song from Land of Talk's new albums, the title track from Some Are Lakes. It's also a lovely song. So let's give that a listen. This is Final Fantasy.
String bass, you're gonna give him a chase, man. He left the devil breathless. Want him to lap tap your tits. He's gonna caution your clits. He talked your whole cherry tree into growing its fruit with no pits. He's the egg that drops in your soup. He's the hand that holds the tottering scoop. Bass, bicycle, braid, and beer. God, damn me, prostrate in fear. He's gonna win the race with his six-string bass. He's gonna summon the hounds now. Here they come now, without a sound now. Swallowed his reed as the drummer ran out in the lead.
Hey, that was Deerhoof from their new album, Offend Maggie, and the song Offend Maggie. I don't know what that means, but, well, look out, Maggie. That album drops October 7th. Before that, we heard Land of Talk with the title track from their new album, Some Are Lakes, and the song Some Are Lakes. And then before that, we heard Ultimatum from the new Final Fantasy EP, which I didn't mention, but it's all songs that were written by Alex Lukashevsky, who has a band called Deep Dark United in Toronto. I don't really know them at all, but clearly if they have the imprimatur of Final Fantasy's approval, then yeah, they're worth a listen. So look out for Deep Dark United. Show listings, shows coming to town tonight. The Raconteurs are at Malcolm Bowl in Stanley Park with the Kills for an all-ages show. Let's hope it doesn't turn to rain out there. Ockerville River is also in town tonight, playing with Seawolf at Richards on Richards. Tomorrow night, like I mentioned before, Mohawk Lodge are playing with Japandroids and Poor Folk at the Biltmore. Fond of Tigers and Secret Mommy are at Open Studios. On Saturday night, Elliot Brood is at Richards and Richards, and Collapsing Opposites and Bible Belts are going to have their kind of tour launch new 7-inch party at the Railway Club. That is going to be heaps of fun, and Greenbelt Collective, Lala, and the Payday Millionaires are going to be there as well. That's the Railway Club on Saturday night. Also Saturday, Vapid and New Sensei are playing with Juvie at the Peanut Gallery. On the 21st, The Good News are playing with Terror Bird at the Bourbon. Rah Rah Riot and Walter Migo are at the Media Club that night. The next night, the 22nd, Sinden is playing with Nacho Lovers and Paul Devereaux at the Modern. Brastonaut is playing at the Biltmore. On the 24th, Novelero from Winnipeg are playing with The Details and The Good News at the Bourbon. On the 25th, A Place to Bury Strangers are playing with Cian Alice Group and Japandroids at the Biltmore. And on the 25th, Cadence Weapon is playing with Woodhands at Richards on Richards. And that's all I'm going to announce. The other thing to keep in mind is that Shindig has started up again. Zombie Pistolero and his guns were triumphant last Tuesday. I didn't make it, but I'm going to try and make it this coming Tuesday night to see Hermetic, Stephanie Lang, and Mr. Chinsletta and the Bitter Litter Babies. Shindig, I love you. That starts up at 9:30 at the Railway Club, and it's always a good time. Bring a joke, win a beer, or get heckled. Either way, you're going to have a great time. This is CITR 101.9 FM. So last Friday, terrible news out of Los Angeles. David Foster Wallace, a great writer, hanged himself. He had suffered from mental health problems for several years. I didn't actually know this, but this past summer he was undergoing electroconvulsive therapy to try and cure address his depression. Anyways, you know, some pretty serious health problems there, but nonetheless, he was an amazing writer, one of my favorites, and kind of as a tribute to him, I was going to play a reading that he did of from his latest book of essays, Consider the Lobster. It's if you haven't read any David Foster Wallace, his nonfiction essays are a great place to start. A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again was published in the late 90s, I think 96, and it's one of the funniest pieces of writing I've ever read. It's about him taking a 7-day cruise through the Caribbean. And a couple of years ago, he released Consider the Lobster, which was a book of essays. There's some stuff about grammar and Dostoevsky and tennis and talk radio. And the title essay is from an expanded version of a feature he wrote for Gourmet magazine about lobsters. And I think it's a pretty good introduction to his thoughtfulness and just the incredible verbal facility. I can't even talk. he was just one of the most amazing writers, and so I wanted to give you guys out there a chance to hear him. And so this is going to be about 15 minutes or so, and this is from Consider the Lobster. So let's see how this is going to work here. Moving over here. Let's see. And here we go.
Consider the Lobster. The enormous, pungent, and extremely well-marketed Maine Lobster Festival is held every late July in the state's mid-coast region, meaning the western side of Penobscot Bay, the nerve stem of Maine's lobster industry. What's called the mid-coast runs from Owl's Head and Thomaston in the south to Belfast in the north. Actually, It might extend all the way up to Bucksport. But we were never able to get farther north than Belfast on Route 1, whose summer traffic is, as you can imagine, unimaginable. The region's two main communities are Camden, with its very old money and yachty harbor and five-star restaurants and phenomenal B&Bs, and Rockland, a serious old fishing town that hosts the festival every summer in historic Harbor Park, right along the water. There's a comprehensive native apothegm: Camden by the sea, Rockland by the smell. Tourism and lobster are the Mid-Coast region's two main industries, and they're both warm-weather enterprises, and the Maine Lobster Festival represents less an intersection of the industries than a deliberate collision, joyful and lucrative and loud. The assigned subject of this gourmet article is the 56th annual MLF, 30 July through 3 August 2003, whose official theme this year was Lighthouses, Laughter, and Lobster. Total paid attendance was over 100,000, due partly to a national CNN spot in June, during which a senior editor of Food and Wine magazine hailed the MLF as one of the best food theme festivals in the world. 2003 festival highlights: concerts by Leanne Womack and Orleans, annual Maine Sea Goddess Beauty Pageant, Saturday's Big Parade, Sunday's William G. Atwood Memorial Crate Race, annual amateur cooking competition, carnival rides and midway attractions and food booths, and the MLF's Maine Eating Tent, where something over 25,000 pounds of fresh-caught Maine lobster is consumed after preparation in the world's largest lobster cooker near the ground's north entrance. Also available are lobster rolls, lobster turnovers, lobster sauté, Downeast lobster salad, lobster bisque, lobster ravioli, and deep-fried lobster dumplings. Lobster thermidor is obtainable at a sit-down restaurant called the Black Pearl on Harbor Park's Northwest Wharf. A large alpine booth sponsored by the Maine Lobster Promotion Council has free pamphlets with recipes, eating tips, and lobster fun facts. The winner of Friday's amateur cooking competition prepares saffron lobster ramekins, the recipe for which is now available for public downloading at www.mainlobsterfestival.com. There are lobster t-shirts and lobster bobblehead dolls and inflatable lobster pool toys and clamp-on lobster hats with big scarlet claws that wobble on springs. Your assigned correspondent saw it all, accompanied by one girlfriend and both his own parents, one of which parents was actually born and raised in Maine, albeit in the extreme northern inland part, which is potato country and a world away from the touristic mid-coast. NB, which means Noto Bini, which the audio commandant wants me to tell you means note well, but actually really means by the way. All personally connected parties have made it clear from the start that they do not want to be talked about in this article. For practical purposes, everyone knows what a lobster is. As usual, though, there's much more to know than most of us care about. It's all a matter of what your interests are. Taxonomically speaking, a lobster is a marine crustacean of the family Homaridae, characterized by five pairs of jointed legs, the first pair terminating in large pincerish claws used for subduing prey. Like many other species of benthic carnivore, lobsters are both hunters and scavengers. They have stalked eyes, gills on their legs, and antennae. There are a dozen or so different kinds worldwide, of which the relevant species here is the Maine lobster, Homarus americanus. The name lobster comes from the Old English lopestre, which is thought to be a corrupt form of the Latin word for locust, combined with the Old English lop, which meant spider. Moreover, a crustacean is an aquatic arthropod of the class Crustacea, which comprises crabs, shrimp, barnacles, lobsters, and freshwater crayfish. All this is right there in the encyclopedia. And arthropods are members of the phylum Arthropoda, which phylum covers insects, spiders, crustaceans, and centipedes/millipedes, all of whose main commonality, besides the absence of a centralized brain-spine assembly, is a chitinous exoskeleton composed of segments to which appendages are articulated in pairs. The point is that lobsters are basically giant sea insects. Mid-Coaster's native term for a lobster is, in fact, bug, as in, come around on Sunday and we'll cook up some bugs. Like most arthropods, they date from the Jurassic period, biologically so much older than mammalia that they might as well be from another planet. And they are, particularly in their natural brown-green state, brandishing their claws like weapons and with thick antennae a whip, not nice to look at. And it's true that they are garbage men of the sea, eaters of dead stuff, although they'll also eat some live shellfish, certain kinds of injured fish, and sometimes one another. Factoid: lobster traps are usually baited with dead herring. But they are themselves good eating, or so we think now. Up until sometime in the 1800s, though, lobster was literally low-class food, eaten only by the poor and institutionalized. Even in the harsh penal environment of early America, some colonies had laws against feeding lobsters to inmates more than once a week because it was thought to be cruel and unusual, like making people eat rats. One reason for their low status was how plentiful lobsters were in old New England. Unbelievable abundance is how one source describes the situation, including accounts of Plymouth pilgrims wading out and capturing all they wanted by hand, and of early Boston's seashore being littered with lobsters after hard storms. These latter were treated as a smelly nuisance and ground up for fertilizer. There is also the fact that pre-modern lobster was cooked dead and then preserved, usually packed in salt or crude hermetic containers. Maine's earliest lobster industry was based around a dozen such seaside canneries in the 1840s, from which lobster was shipped as far away as California, in demand only because it was cheap and high in protein, basically chewable fuel. Now, of course, lobster is posh, a delicacy, only a step or two down from caviar. The meat is richer and more substantial than most fish, its taste subtle compared to the marine gaminess of mussels and clams. In the U.S. pop food imagination, lobster is now the seafood analog to steak, with which it's so often twinned as surf and turf on the really expensive part of the chain steakhouse menu. In fact, one obvious project of the MLF and of its omnipresently sponsorial Maine Lobster Promotion Council is to counter the idea that lobster is unusually looks or unhealthy or expensive, suitable only for effete palates or the occasional blow-the-diet treat. It is emphasized over and over in presentations and pamphlets at the festival that lobster meat has fewer calories, less cholesterol, and less saturated fat than chicken. Of course, the common practice of dipping the lobster meat in melted butter torpedoes all these happy fat specs, which none of the council's promotional stuff ever mentions, any more than potato industry PR talks about sour cream and bacon bits. And in the main eating tent, you can get a quarter, which is industry shorthand for a 1 1/4 pound lobster, a 4-ounce cup of melted butter, a bag of chips, and a soft roll with butter pat for around $12, which is only slightly more expensive than supper at McDonald's. Be apprised, though, that the Maine Lobster Festival's democratization of lobster comes with all the massed inconvenience and aesthetic compromise of true democracy. See, for example, the aforementioned Maine eating tent, for which there is a constant Disneyland-grade queue, and which turns out to be a square quarter mile of awning-shaded cafeteria lines and rows of long institutional tables at which friend and stranger alike sit cheek by jowl, cracking and chewing and dribbling. It's hot, and the sagged roof traps the steam and the smells, which latter are strong and only partly food-related. It is also loud, and a good percentage of the total noise is masticatory. The suppers come in styrofoam trays, and the soft drinks are iceless and flat, and the coffee is convenience store coffee in more styrofoam, and the utensils are plastic. There are none of the special long skinny forks for pushing out the tail meat, though a few savvy diners bring their own. Nor do they give you near enough napkins, considering how messy lobster is to eat, especially when you're squeezed onto benches alongside children of various ages and vastly different levels of fine motor development, not to mention the people who've somehow smuggled in their own beer in enormous aisle-blocking coolers, or who all of a sudden produce their own plastic tablecloths and spread them over large portions of tables to try to reserve them, the tables, for their own little groups, and so on. Any one example is no more than a petty inconvenience, of course, but the MLF turns out to be full of irksome little downers like this. See, for instance, the main stage's headliner shows, where it turns out that you have to pay $20 extra for a folding chair if you want to sit down, or the North Tent's mad scramble for the NyQuil cup-sized samples of finalist entries handed out after the cooking competition, or the much-touted Maine Sea Goddess pageant finals, which turn out to be excruciatingly long and to consist mainly of endless thanks and tributes to local sponsors. Let's not even talk about the grossly inadequate port-a-san facilities or the fact that there's nowhere to wash your hands before or after eating. What the Maine Lobster Festival really is a mid-level county fair with a culinary hook. And in this respect, it's not unlike Tidewater Crab Festivals, Midwest Corn Festivals, Texas Chili Festivals, etc., and shares with these venues the core paradox of all teeming commercial demotic events. It's not for everyone. In truth, there's a great deal to be said about the differences between working-class Rockland and the heavily populist flavor of its festival versus comfortable and elitist Camden with its expensive view and shops given entirely over to $200 sweaters and great rows of Victorian homes converted to upscale B&Bs. And about these differences as two sides of the great coin that is U.S. tourism. Very little of which will be said here except to amplify the above-mentioned paradox and to reveal your assigned correspondent's own preferences. I confess that I have never understood why so many people's idea of a fun vacation is to don flip-flops and sunglasses and crawl through maddening traffic to loud, hot, crowded tourist venues in order to sample a local flavor that is by definition ruined by the presence of tourists. This may, as my festival companions keep pointing out, all be a matter of personality and hardwired taste. The fact that I do not like tourist venues means that I'll never understand their appeal, and so am probably not the one to talk about it, the supposed appeal. But since this footnote will almost surely not survive magazine editing anyway, here goes. As I see it, it probably really is good for the soul to be a tourist, even if it's only once in a while. Not good for the soul in a refreshing or enlivening way, though, but rather in a grim, steely-eyed, let's look honestly at the facts and find some way to deal with them way. My personal experience has not been that traveling around the country is broadening or relaxing, or that radical changes in place and context have a salutary effect, but rather that intranational tourism is radically constricting and humbling in the hardest way, hostile to my fantasy of being a true individual, of living somehow outside and above it all. Coming up is the part that my companions find especially unhappy and repellent, a sure way to spoil the fun of vacation travel. To be a mass tourist, for me, is to become a pure late-date American, alien, ignorant, greedy for something you cannot ever have, disappointed in a way you can never admit. It is to spoil, by way of sheer ontology, the very unspoiledness you are there to experience. It is to impose yourself on places that in all non-economic ways would be better, realer, without you. It is, in lines and gridlock and transaction after transaction, to confront a dimension of yourself that is as inescapable as it is painful. As a tourist, you become economically significant but existentially loathsome, an insect on a dead thing.
She wore blue velvet, bluer than velvet was the night, softer than satin was the light from the stars. She wore blue. Sighs. Love was ours. Ours, love I held tightly. Feeling the rapture grow. Like a flame burning brightly. But when she left, gone was the glow of blue velvet. But in my heart there'll always be precious and warm a memory. Through the years, and I still can see blue velvet through my tears. She wore blue velvet, but in my heart there'll always be and warm a memory. Through the years, and I still can see blue velvet through my
The 27th Annual Vancouver International Film Festival will be held September 25th to October 10th, 2008. VIFF is among the largest film festivals in North America and is one of the largest cultural events in Canada. The broad spectrum of fiction and non-fiction films from around the world is divided into the following sections. The Ark, Elements and Animals. Dragons and Tigers, The Cinemas of East Asia. Non-fiction features. Canadian Images, Cinema of Our Time, and Spotlights on France.
Films are screened on the following 10 screens. Empire Granville 7 Cinemas, Van City Theatre at the Vancouver International Film Centre, Pacific Cinematheque, Ridge Theatre. To purchase tickets, visit the Vancouver International Film Festival Centre on Seymour. For information, check out www.viff.org or call 604-683-FILM. That's 604-683-3456.
Yes, it comes in a downward direction. It disintegrates, dissolves, melts everything.
Film Fest starts next Thursday. Very exciting. So at the top there, we heard an excerpt from Consider the Lobster by David Foster Wallace, who died last Friday. I hope you liked it. Maybe his humor isn't totally apparent. He has a very dry delivery, but I think he's hilarious. And I hope you liked it. And again, if you are interested in finding out more about him, you can check out his books, Consider the Lobster, or a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again. There's also Infinite Jest, which is his famous giant novel. It's over 1,000 pages long. I've never actually attempted it, but those who have said it's definitely worthwhile. And if you're if you are a fan of David Foster Wallace, McSweeney's.net, a website, has a bunch of kind of testimonials about him. And I don't know, it was really nice to read some of those things about him. So check that out. After that, we heard the song Blue Velvet by Bobby Vinton. In that first book of essays by Dave Wallace, he wrote about Blue Velvet and David Lynch. And so I thought that was a fitting musical way to finish that up. You've been listening to Dunkin's Donuts on CITR 101.9. If you like what you heard, check out the podcast at CITR.ca, or check out our blog at dunkinsdonuts.wordpress.com. Coming up, Marielle has We All Fall Down, and then Robin with Ink Studs, and Brendan and Cody with Crimes and Treasons. As always, Dunkin's Donuts is brought to you by the Biltmore Cabaret. Check out biltmorecabaret.com for more information. And to finish us out here today, we're going to hear some Chris Horrific. His band, Bible Belts, are about to go on tour with Collapsing Opposites, who maybe we'll hear a song from as well if we can squeeze it in. So we're going to hear Fight, 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 Ryan Fight, which is about the guy from Collapsing Opposites. That's a Chris Horrific song, and then we might hear some Collapsing Opposites if we have time. It's getting kind of close. Maybe we won't. No, we're not going to hear that. The Chris Horrific song is going to have to encapsulate what's best about both bands. All right, All right. And they're playing Saturday night at the Railway Club, and then they're going on tour. So you should get down there and check them out. Thanks for listening. Take care. Be well. And see you next week.
Faster on purpose. I used up all my favorites.